Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 65, titled Transcendent Wisdom and Transcendent Love.
The main thing to tell you about this is this whole thing about voidness or emptiness. I prefer voidness simply because it's one syllable less than emptiness. And also it's not an ordinary word, so it's sort of more unusual word, so I like it for that reason. So, but it's same, you know. So being void of intrinsic reality, and the concept of intrinsic reality may be new to some of you. And what intrinsic reality means is the idea that things have an essential quality in them that is that their existence, that sustains their existence. They have like an essence. Like the floor is intrinsically really the floor. And intrinsic means without, not in relation to something else. It's the floor in itself. You know, like Plato, for example, there's the idea of a sort of the idea, the pure form of floorness that is instantiated in a particular floor. That's the essence of the floor. And a kind of substantiality, a substantial floorness. So therefore, our concept of floor seems to meet an objective, irreducible, real thing that is the real floor, if you follow me. And that's called the floor's intrinsic reality, not its relational reality, a non-relational essential reality. Do you follow that? And at first we think, well, that's silly. We know everything is only interrelated. We know we're in the 21st century era of relativity. You know, even in the beginning of 20th century, Westerners finally discovered relativity. But the way our perceptual habit operates in the Buddhist analysis is that we think of things, we habitually perceive things as having intrinsic reality or intrinsic identity, and particularly we perceive ourselves as having an intrinsic identity. Like, I'm really, as my old Mongolian teacher used to say, people are correct that they exist and that they're real. Everyone is real. But the problem is each person thinks they're really real. And that's where they exaggerate the quality of the reality that they have. You know, like, I'm real Bob. I'm really Bob, you know, Thurman. You know, like, my identity of Bob Thurman is a real essential thing. It's an intrinsic identity that, you know, that my name sort of fits on. But inside, when I, you know, I'm really me type of thing. So, for example, when my inner voice tells me I hate this or I love that or I don't know about the other, I believe it. And I think that's really my condition. And similarly, when I perceive the floor, they have something. There's a great term that sociologists of knowledge use in English called massive facticity, which I particularly love. You know, that something is a fact. And then we invest in it, though, a kind of massive facticity, like it's a real fact, you know, like that's really the wall, this is really this, and that's really that. And according to the Buddhist analysis from ancient time, very sophisticated, you know, epistemological, psychological analysis. That kind of mental habit that not only human beings but animals have, although animals have no access to it, investigating it because they don't have the language and the self-reflective level that humans do, but humans can. And that is the source of all of our trouble. When we, you know, kill for an idea, or in the old days when people killed between Allah and Jehovah, you know, which was really the same, you know, Abrahamic concept of the deity, but had different names, but the word seemed to really hit the thing for the different people on the two sides, and then they would kill each other over that. Or when people feel someone with another language or another race is alien in some way, it's because of their thinking, or it's like the modern philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein was very Buddhist when he used to make a joke about the famous Frenchman, who was a real sort of existentialist and a secularist and everything. But in his elder age, he converted to Catholicism because he decided that God must have had really good taste in order to design the world to fit perfectly with the French language. He kind of joked about it. That was Wittgenstein's wonderful joke. Because he discerned this, actually. He was almost the first to really discern this in the West. And subsequently, other philosophers have followed suit. Although they think that means they unfortunately then go to the side of nihilism, thinking that everything is nothing. And many Buddhists in history have thought that emptiness was equivalent to nothingness. And in early translations, you had people translating it as nothingness. But it's very, very different from nothingness. In fact, nothingness itself also has no intrinsic reality. Nothing itself doesn't exist. Emptiness is empty of itself, but emptiness really is the quality of the relationality of everything, the fact that everything is empty of any non-relational component. So when you're in a towering rage, when you're in a completely irresistible obsession of some kind of greed or desire or lust or something, where you feel carried away by this particular, or jealousy or pride or confusion or depression, it's where you feel that your mood or your inner voice that says, I must this, I hate that, I have to have the other, I hate, you know, when you're like that, you could use the word that we have kind of created in translating Buddhist texts, you absolutize that feeling, that emotion becomes an absolute to you. And you can tell that it becomes an absolute to you because all the damage that you do when you're in a rage or in some other, gripped by some other emotion, it has to do with your failing to connect in a related way to whatever you're dealing with. So therefore, people will even kill themselves. They get so angry. They will harm someone that they love. They will destroy something that they value because the relationship, relationality becomes useless because they become the tool of that emotion, which becomes an absolute to them, if you follow me. Whereas when you realize emptiness at a visceral, when you reach a visceral way of realizing it, which requires at first that you have a rational way of understanding it, and then your meditative power intensifies that rational thing where it goes and it changes your gut habit of relating to everything on the sort of absolutist way. But when you do, then you feel really depressed. Oh, it's all worthless. I should kill myself. But then, well, who's saying that? Well, what? Who's speaking? Then you develop another voice. You become aware. That's why it led to mindfulness becomes part of it. But also there, beyond just being aware of what's in your mind, you actually go in and edit, and you see through the delusion of having to freely follow what's in your mind, if you follow me. You really become free in mind. And this is voidness with respect to intrinsic reality. So he says, void, so the five body-mind processes, now the five body-mind processes are the famous aggregates, the skandhas, which are the physical processes, the sensational processes, the cognitional or conceptual processes, the emotional, mainly emotional processes, and then consciousness processes themselves. And those are called the five aggregates, which is just a heuristic way of analyzing your own body-mind process. And so he says that he looked through these layers of his being, most subtle being the consciousness, most coarse being the physical body. And in those, he found everything to be empty of any intrinsic reality. For example, the Buddhists, as scientists, 2,500 years ago, they preceded quantum physics by insisting against the physics of the day in India that there was no such thing as an indivisible atom, that everything is infinitely divisible until it disappears under analysis. If you fully analyze anything, it will dissolve under analysis. You'll keep taking it apart and apart. Finally, you won't be able to find anything, which was a shock to people, just as it was when the quantum people just found out that, you know, the wave particle paradox type of thing, you know, that finally you don't know what's there because it disappears when you look for it intensively enough, if you follow me. This was discovered 2,500 years ago, actually. And then rather than feeling insecure because there's nothing solid that you're sitting in, and you're nothing solid that you have even as a body, it makes you more free. You become aware that you are an interactive being at different levels of coarseness and subtlety. And yet, ultimately, you might disappear under analysis, but you're still there as a relative process, if you follow me. And we'll talk more about that later. But that's considered, therefore, that's the realization of emptiness. And it's a very, very powerful thing. And therefore, the list that is recited here, which we will recite in every one of our classes from now on in the retreat, reminds us of this, And he puts everything in the list. The five aggregates, which are the matter. Imagine the shock of thinking that. Now, we have a model of atom due to modern pre-quantum science, that the atom has a nucleus, and then it has electrons in orbit around it. And therefore, an atom is mostly empty space, right? The nucleus, they say it's like a flea on central plate in Yankee Stadium, and the electrons are like other fleas flying around in the bleachers. And the rest of it is the empty space of Yankee Stadium, and that's atom. So that's what your hard bone is made of, supposedly, or the chair, or the floor, or a rock. Mostly it's empty space, in other words, even in that model. But the Buddhist and the quantum people, even the nucleus is equally empty, in other words. And so, but the emptiness is not the emptiness between the hard things. The emptiness is the possibility of all the hard things relating to each other. So the emptiness is also the hard things. You follow me? The voidness. So that's why that's such a shocking statement to us. Voidness is matter. Matter is voidness. If a rock hits my hand, it seems like a hard contact that's kind of irreducible to me. But the only reason it can hit my hand is the rock is not an intrinsic reality disconnected from its relationships, and my hand isn't either. So they can relate by one hitting the other. Do you follow me? Because both are empty. So emptiness becomes the field of interrelatedness of everything, if you follow me. So then he makes the five aggregates are matter, sensations, conceptions, mental functions, and consciousnesses. And they're all empty. And then then he gives a list of synonyms of this voidness or emptiness. Signless, uncreated, unceased, stainless, impeccable, undecreased, and unincreased. So that's all things are like that. And then there is no such thing as these five aggregates. And then about your own senses, there's no eye, no ear, no nose. I particularly like the no nose one. Some of you who have studied with me a little bit before, you know that one. For I challenge you, and those of you who are new to it, I challenge you to find your nose. And of course, everybody goes, "What if you have? There it is." They go like that. And then, but actually, they're touching a piece of skin, which, depending on the level of pressure, the size of it varies. And then, of course, the plastic surgeon, if they didn't like their nose, they could cut that off and make a different shape and put a different piece of skin there. So actually, the piece of skin is not actually the nose. But you would say, well, it's part of the nose. Well, temporarily, it's part of the nose. And then when you say it, even, what exactly are you referring to? And as you know, an absolute point of XY is an absolute point of XY. I don't know what that is. Did I do something? A point of XY has no size, so it actually isn't there. An exact point. So there's no exact place on the nose. Then the boundary between the nose and the cheek, where is it? There's no exact line. It's arbitrary. And the air inside the nostril, is that the nose or not the nose? And where do you make a shield in front of the nose, etc.? In other words, your nose is there when you don't look at it to pinpoint it in precise detail. When you try to really find it under analysis, to really say, this exactly is my nose, it will dissolve under your analysis. So you are running around with a nose. And Dalai Lama likes to tease, if you're a Westerner, then your nose is like a hood ornament in front of a car, you know. Like it's always like in the old cars where they had hood ornaments standing up like Pontiac, you know, something. But if you're Oriental, then you can't see the tip of your own nose, so don't get too cross-eyed by meditating on the tip of your nose. And he loves to tease Western people with that. Point is, it's something that's there when you don't look too hard at it, which means it's a relational object. It's a kind of arbitrary in its definition. There's no intrinsically real nose, right? Which is when you really viscerally know that, actually, you can kind of relax about your nose. You kind of don't worry. As you young people don't know what I mean, but older ones do, because your nose changes. It starts to sag a little. It's like it starts to become different. And you can get nervous about it if you think that really my nose is this way or that way. And then similarly, no tongue, no body, and then all these more subtle things, eye to mentality. And then this one, there's no ignorance, no cessation of ignorance, and no up to no old age and death and no cessation. Those are the 12 links of dependent origination. which is just going a very important Buddhist set of concepts, but we're not going. I won't go into detail. And then these four: no suffering, no origination, no cessation, no path. Those are the four noble truths. And he's saying none of them. There's no such thing. Any of them, meaning there's no intrinsically real suffering. There's no intrinsically real freedom from suffering, etc. That doesn't mean there isn't suffering and freedom from suffering, but on a superficial level. And no intuitiveness. And then the one that I do love, no attainment, but no non-attainment. So nobody is not attained, because we're all in, actually, non-dual perfect reality, in fact. But we don't know that. So so then he goes, and then he has the nice mantra. The mantra means gone, gone, very totally gone, enlightenment, all hail, is what it means. Gate, gate. And then he finishes, and then the Buddha realizes. So that's what it is. Now, I wanted to read in that light. I wanted to read one other thing from the Vimalakirti Sutra, because this retreat we're looking at wisdom and love, and with an emphasis on love. But it's rooted in the wisdom, actually, either for Theravada or Mahayana or anything. Without the wisdom, it cannot really be powerful. Even though at any level, of course, it's good, but it can't really work. Because love is the will to the happiness of the beloved. And if you sit around staring at someone and say, I wish you were happy, and you really do, but it's not going to necessarily make them happy. But if you have wisdom, you will figure out how to make them happy, definitely. And actually, the vibration of your wisdom, your sense of freedom within yourself, of the taking their state of unhappiness for real, or even thinking that there's a real, intrinsically real happiness that they can have, even that makes you happy. And once you're more happy, that already helps them. But anyway, there's a challenge to this idea. And Manjushri, this has to do with the conversation between Vimalakirti and Manjushri and the Vimalakirti teaching sutra. And Manjushri, the crown prince of wisdom, asks Vimalakirti, he says, good sir, how should a bodhisattva regard all living beings? And Vimalakirti replies, bodhisattva, Manjushri, a bodhisattva should regard all living beings as a wise man regards the reflection of the moon in water, or as magicians regard men created by magic. That is to say, is a little bit unreal. So he's echoing the idea of emptiness here, voidness of intrinsic reality. He should regard them as being like a face in a mirror, like the water of a mirage, like the sound of an echo, like a mass of clouds in the sky, like the previous moment of a ball of foam, like the appearance and disappearance of a bubble of water, like the core of a plantain tree, like a flash of lightning, like the fifth great element. There's no five elements, there's only four, earth, water, fire, wind, and like the seventh sense medium, like etc. It goes on, there's some funny ones, like a tortoise hair fur coat. That's a funny one. Like the fun of games for one who wishes to die. Like the egoistic views of a stream winner, that is a Theravada state of a level of enlightenment. Like a third rebirth of a once returner, like the descent of a non-returner into a womb, like the existence of desire, hatred, and folly in a saint, like thoughts of, etc. It goes on, I don't want to read all of it, but like a fire burning without fuel, like the reincarnation of one who has attained ultimate liberation. Precisely thus, Manjushri, does a bodhisattva who realizes ultimate selflessness consider all beings. So Manjushri then asked further, noble sir, if a bodhisattva considers all living beings in such a way, how does he generate the great love toward them? In other words, if you think of beings as unreal in some sense, like a mirage or all these things, how can you generate the great love for them? Why would you care about whether they're happy or not? Because even their suffering is a mirage. That you see it as a mirage, as an unreal thing, which is a very good question. And Vimalakirti has a wonderful reply. He says, Manjushri, when a bodhisattva considers all living beings in this way, he thinks, just as I have realized the Dharma, and here Dharma means in the sense of what reality, not just the teaching, so should I teach it to living beings. Thereby he generates, and that's very important to realize that Dharma has that meaning. You know, normally we think of Dharma as teaching, and it can mean 11 different things, but its highest meaning is the reality that is taught. So, for example, when one takes refuge in the Dharma, as they put it in Buddhism, it means taking refuge in reality. Buddha's good news, if you will, upon his enlightenment was that reality is nirvana. Reality is freedom from suffering. Suffering is only caused by being trapped by ignorance in unreality, which is kind of a different view in his day that people did not have. And in general, people don't have that idea. If you stop to think, what do you think reality is? Those of us who were brought up in a materialistic, science-dominated reality view culture, we think reality, finally, is nothing. Nothingness. You know, the dark space between the stars, between the galaxies, right? The dark, the empty space inside the atom. The deep unconsciousness we will enter at death. That's the kind of the final reality we will reach. We are taught to think that, actually, if we're brought up that way as a reality sense. We may be religious, and we may go against that reality sense and say, no, I believe in God, I believe in Jesus, I believe in love, I believe in nirvana, I believe in something else. But our science class formed education taught us that that's all kind of some old superstition, and the real thing is it all comes down to nothing. And there is no future life and all this kind of thing. And many people think Buddhism thinks that by talking about emptiness, but totally wrong. Totally not so. One of Buddha's greatest insights is Eureka. Nothing is just that, nothing. So it's not a place, it's not a reality, it can't go there, and it's not there. There's no there about nothing. So nobody, don't worry, you'll never be nothing, or do worry, because you'll never be nothing. You'll always be something, and then the quality of that something becomes very, very crucial for you. What kind of something will it be? Becomes a really crucial point. Okay, so just as I have realized the Dharma, meaning reality in this case, so should I teach it to beings. And the implication there is that it made him happy. The Bodhisattva is happy when they know that reality is all right. And so that had made them happy. So therefore, they should teach it to beings. Thereby, he generates the love that is truly a refuge for all living beings. Meaning, now if love is defined, as it is in Buddhism, as the will to the happiness of whatever you love, the beloved, which could be yourself too, could be any or any being, that they be happy, that's loving them, in other words. Love here is not to be mixed with the greed or desire to possess and this sort of thing. It doesn't mean that. Maitri, you know the word Maitri. And actually in the Buddhist translations, the translation loving kindness came up in Sri Lanka originally and also in East Asia because it was a response to colonialism. Because the colonialist people conquered Asia and they talked about Jesus and how much we love you, but now we're going to enslave you in our colonial empire. So they didn't like that love. So then they wanted to make sure that they added kindness in there. Not loving imperialism, but the word Maitri is like a mother's love, like a friend's love, you know. It is the feeling of someone who generally wants the one they love to be happy. That's what it means. It's like the agape in the Greek sense, the agape love more than the eros, but maybe finally they're connected, actually. They should be. The love that is peaceful because free of grasping. You know, it's a refuge, therefore. Why? Because by realizing reality, a person becomes a refuge because they know realistically. It's like the other people, the ignorant person is paranoid because they think reality is very dangerous and they are like fighting it off and they're trying to protect themselves from it and they don't want to be vulnerable to it and they don't want to be too open to people because they might be abused and all this and maybe they have been abused by someone who's also frightened of them and therefore is abusing them because of their frustration and so forth. And so they're used to only meeting other people who are all guarded, and then it's like, yeah, okay, a little bit handshake reaching out from the two islands of paranoia. That sort of relationships are like that. But someone who has realized reality they realize that no one can destroy them, that live or die, reality itself is bliss. And they will have a continuous blissful being once they're open to that and they're aware of that. And therefore, they are truly happy from within, not because they own this or have that or in this or that situation. They're truly happy because the nature of the reality of themselves they have realized is happiness. They have had that realization, to some degree at least. And that makes them a refuge, because even some paranoid person is to confront them, and they don't get into it with that person. And they may or may not be able to reach out to them, depending on how guarded and how paranoid that other person is. But just by being the way they are, there's a kind of radiation from them that reassures that person subliminally, let's say. You know, like people always weep when they meet the Dalai Lama. They tend to, a lot of them do. And Dalai Lama himself, when he was younger, he used to kind of a little bit like, well, those are Mongolians that weep, are sentimental people. Now he weeps all the time, you know, himself. The Dalai Lama does. He gets very easily touched, and he's very more open in his older, since he became, he walked his talk, and he really opened more deeply himself. And but people do when they meet him, but even, and the reason is partly maybe their projection, but I think also it is that they feel someone who sees them in a way takes them less seriously than they take themselves in one way, and the other way is totally concerned with whatever their problem is, because in a way doesn't have a big problem himself. And even though he should be having massive problem of the responsibility of all the Tibetans and the danger that the world is in and everything as a very sensitive being, but people sense that, and they feel a feeling of relief, therefore. And they tend to weep in his presence, actually. And they get all emotional, people do. I just did an interview with him, and I had a whole list of questions for some journal thing. And I ruined my interview because I forgot all my questions. And, you know, I just, what's my concert? And, you know, I only had a certain amount of time, and it was, like, really bad. But it ended up being fine, because whatever he does and says is useful. But I didn't ask a bunch of the hard questions that I wanted to ask. So that's the love that is truly a refuge for all living beings. The love that is peaceful because free of grasping. For example, it's peaceful. A person who's already happy and cannot have their happiness dislodged because it is their reality in their direct, visceral, as well as intellectual experience, you know, gut experience, they are peaceful. They don't need to grasp at any other thing. They have no more desire for any kind of lesser thing. And that was the secret for Buddha's mother. When Buddha's mother, after she gave birth to Buddha, even though it was the totally easiest birth of all time, according to, you could say, a legend if you're a materialist, but Buddhists think it really happened. He was kind enough not to have, you know, give her 12 hours of labor or something. He just emanated through the atoms, through the space, and just jumped outside and walked around. And he said some more things until his dad came. He didn't talk when dad came. He didn't want to freak him out. But he talked to his mom. And he held up one finger, you know, said, I'm the best thing on 2 feet. And he said. And he was, I think. He was. Anyway, but then the mother, when the father came, she said, listen, I've had Buddha in here for 10 lunar months, 9 solar months, 10 lunar months. And I'm very blissed out. And I'm sorry, Your Majesty, husband dear, but the infrastructure back in your country there is just not up to it. And I don't feel like it. So I'm going to the heaven of Indra. Goodbye. I did my job. And my sister will take care of the baby. And she took off because she was too blissed out, you know, to bother with it all a little bit. That's the story anyway. But that's because also she had to give birth to Buddhas in a billion different worlds simultaneously. She's very busy, Maya. She is. She's too busy to hang out that long in any one country. So the love that is not feverish because free of passions. The love that accords with reality because it is equanimous in all three times. The love that is to say it sees past, present, and future as all present in any moment. The love that is without conflict because free of the violence of the passions. The love that is non-dual because it is involved neither with the external nor with the internal. The love that is imperturbable because totally ultimate. Thereby he generates the love that is firm. So in other words, it's like the force. I'm supposed to do a new version of this, edit it more. I'm going to do he, she alternating, actually. in the future. I'm tired of this he all the time. It annoys me when I see it. I apologize. In Sanskrit, it's an inflected language, you know, with case endings different for male and female. But the grammatical rule of Panini, of the ancient Vedic Sanskrit grammar, classical Sanskrit grammar, is that the male stands for the female, you know, like mankind, you know, includes the female. But I still, nowadays, I think it's still misleading. So I think I should alternate he and she. And I'm going to. The love that is pure. Oh, no. He generates the love that is firm. It's high resolve, unbreakable like a diamond. That's the force, the diamond force. You know? And because the person is no longer a personal thing, like the absolute me loves this absolute you, and I know you're so unhappy, and I really want to help you and do something, etc. Well, no. The relational me, yes, wants you to be happy, but luckily it sees that you have happiness right there in your being, and you just have to remove some veils that you have around yourself that are clouding your vision of your own reality. So that makes it much more doable. It's like beings are curable. In other words, it's like the doctor who sees beings as curable. He therefore is optimistic. He has a good bedside manner, or she has a good bedside manner, because he doesn't see the being as hopeless, you see. So that's this kind of love, you know. The love that is pure, purified in its intrinsic nature. Meaning it realizes its intrinsic nature is the emptiness of intrinsic nature. So total relationality. The love that is even, its aspirations being equal. The saint's love that has eliminated its enemy. The bodhisattva's love that continuously develops living beings. The Buddha's love that understands reality. The Buddha's love that causes living beings to awaken from their sleep. The love that is spontaneous because it is fully enlightened spontaneously. The love that is enlightenment because it is unity of experience. The love that has no presumption because it has eliminated attachment and aversion. The love that is great compassion. Compassion is defined as the will to the freedom from suffering of all beings. So the love means wanting the other beloved to be happy, and compassion means wanting them not to suffer. So it's like two sides of a circuit, love and compassion. The love that is great compassion because it infuses the universal vehicle with radiance. The love that is never exhausted because it acknowledges emptiness and selflessness. The love that is giving because it bestows the gift of the Dharma free of the tight fist of a bad teacher. That's an expression of a teacher who holds back something and doesn't share it with the pupil, thinking that they want to remain superior to the pupil because they know something the pupil doesn't. That's considered a flaw of a teacher. The love that is morality because it improves immoral living beings. The love that is tolerance because it protects both self and others. The love that is effort because it takes responsibility for all living beings. The love that is contemplation because it refrains from indulgence in tastes. The love that is wisdom because it causes attainment at the proper time. The love that is liberative art because it shows the way everywhere. The love that is without formality because it is pure in motivation. The love that is without deviation because it acts from decisive motivation. The love that is high resolve because it is without passions. The love that is without deceit because it is not artificial. The love that is happiness because it introduces living beings to the happiness of the Buddha. Such Manjushri is the great love of the Bodhisattva. Okay, I read a few things. And I forgot how much time it is and whatever much time we have. So that's the connection, in other words, that is sort of the crux of things, I think, which is emptiness and compassion. And the great slogan for that was Nagarjuna's famous statement, Shunyata Karuna Garbham in Sanskrit. I'm longing to have Krishna Das teach me to sing that.
Nice.
Shunyata Karuna Garbham. And Shunyata means emptiness or voidness. And Karuna means compassion. And Garbha means a womb. So this is the idea that instead of nothingness, what voidness is something like a delicate, nurturing membrane, which is the membrane of total interrelatedness and total interconnection with every being. And the infinite energy of the bliss of the reality of that mass of life, of that great body of life, you could say, which is inexhaustible in the sense that then when you realize that, then you draw on the need of beings to find their own happiness, which and then you can and that is inexhaustible because They have it already there. They already have it. They already are made of it. So it's not like some remote, you know, idealistic thing. It's reality itself. So it enables the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to survive all the terrible things that happen on what Star Trek would call a grade B type zero planet, where they wouldn't want to infuse too much technology when they beam down. But it enables them to even tackle such planets, you know, like the Klingon planet or something, the Romulan planet. I think they never really settled the Romulans, but they did. At least they got Worf, you know, the Klingons. They fixed them up. Okay.